It's the Nahum Segal Network, and welcome to Buy the Book, brought to you by our friends at Koren Publishers. This week we analyze a Yeshiva University Magid Books release. Of course, Magid being an imprint of Koren Publishers, it is a book that's not an easy challenge for someone like myself. It's from the Ritz Hashkafa series, and it's called The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. And in just a moment, I will introduce to you both the author and the editor of this work. I remind you that as we continue our amazing relationship with Koren and Magid Books, a reminder that they're now available at Jewish bookstores everywhere, including our friends at J. Levine at 5 West 30th Street between Broadway and 5th Avenue in New York City. There's also something called a commuter's special. You can bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color. Order a subscription to the print edition of the Koren Talmud Bavli and get a free digital edition. The digital edition is compatible on all mobile devices, including iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. Package has a $60 value for each volume, perfect for your commute to work. Go to korenpub.com. You could use the promo code JM and the AM at checkout to take advantage of this offer. Again, that's korenpub.com, and again, we recommend you take advantage of the offer. The Philosophical Quest is now hot off the press. The Philosophical Quest is the latest publication in partnership between Magid Books and Yeshiva University. In the Philosophical Quest, Rabbi Dr. J. David Bleich's expertise spans the fields of philosophy, ethics, law, and halacha. Much of his prolific scholarly writing focuses upon the interface of these disciplines. The Philosophical Quest includes discussions of the central principles of faith that define the essence of Judaism, analyses of particular principles such as the nature of the deity, providence, prophecy, and revelation. Written from the perspective of an eminent authority on Jewish law, trained in academic philosophy, and noted for presenting complex subjects with rare clarity and accuracy, the Philosophical Quest constitutes a unique contribution to Jewish scholarship and serves as an invaluable source book for student and scholar alike. With that in mind, I introduce our two guests. Rabbi J. David Bleich is a Rosh Yeshiva and Rosh Kolel Hora at the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, professor of law at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law, and Herbert and Florence Tenzer, professor of law and ethics at Yeshiva University, also editor of With Perfect Faith and co-editor of Jewish Bioethics. Rabbi Bleich, welcome to Buy the Book.
Good morning.
Morning. Pleasure to speak with you. Rabbi Daniel Feldman is a Magid Shir in the Stone Beit Midrash program at Yeshiva University. He is director of rabbinic research at YU Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Feldman is editor of the Ritz Halacha and Hashkafa series, a partnership between Magid Books and Yeshiva University. Rabbi Feldman, welcome to the Nahum Segal Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's a pleasure to speak to both of you. And normally I'll start with why write the book, but in this case, I think I'd start with how does one write this book? We're talking about, for an average person, a very, very complicated topic, and one where there's enough difficulty just understanding the title. So, Rabbi Bleich, how does one go about putting together the Philosophical Quest?
It's like asking a centipede, how do you walk? One proceeds to put things in writing. A great deal of this material came as a result of lectures and shiurim. A lot of them go back to an earlier period in this academic incarnation in which I taught philosophy in Stern College for Women. Some of them are actually halachic publications dealing with philosophical aspects of halacha that were part of shiurim and were part of my regular column and tradition. And writing the book is easy. All you do is take the articles and you put them between a hardcover. along the way, you do some editorial work, put in some more footnotes, additions, et cetera, et cetera.
Rabbi Feldman, is it difficult to carry out your job of editing the Halacha and Hashkafa series?
Well, not in this case. As you hear, Rabbi Bleich does a lot of his own editing, a lot of his own work, and we have some very able assistants here. In general, we have a number of series going on, even just focusing on our work with Koren Magid. So this represents basically the third series that we've started with them.
Understood. Rabbi Bleich, it's interesting to me that, and I always leave it to me to look for the trivial aspects in terms of how the book is presented. The first, the introduction and the first couple of chapters focus on the topic of faith and the importance of faith in our tradition. Yet the word faith is not even in the title that includes words like ethics, law, and halacha. One must one go ahead and establish how important faith is our tradition before exploring any of this?
I think that that was the focus of the introduction as well as the first two chapters. The term faith probably doesn't appear in the title. I must confess I don't spend a great deal of time thinking about titles, but I think I would subsume it under the word philosophy. Philosophy in this case isn't simply the term faith isn't right. Simply the statement of certain Ikrim principles of faith, but the philosophical underpinning, where that comes from and what it means in terms of Judaism in general. So, you know, faith is certainly the starting point, and indeed one of the reasons for publishing the book is to emphasize its role in Jewish tradition. And the significant part of the book is devoted to explication of principles of faith. So that the fact that the word isn't in the title is long enough. We certainly didn't want to put another word in the title. I wouldn't focus too strongly on that.
Oh, I understood, just pointing out a little, what was to me looked like an aberration. So how important then is faith to the reader? In other words, must one go ahead and establish that they either have a faith or believe in something in order to explore these issues?
The answer is you don't have to have faith in order to explore the issues. You don't have to be Jewish to enjoy Levy's rye bread was the ad in the subways once upon a time.
Right.
But in order to understand Judaism, you certainly have to understand the faith commitments of Judaism. Hopefully, Hamor Shebahem is Malziran Lamutav, one delves into the principles of faith and their sources, expositions in early philosophers, early Jewish authorities, one comes to appreciate the faith and assimilate it. But the work is as much a work for the beginner as it is for the person who is already committed. It's designed to tell people what Judaism is all about and to emphasize that Judaism involves a very significant faith component. It's not simply a matter of mitzvahs masiyos, you know, active participation in Jewish rituals, etc., but it involves intellectual commitment as well.
Traditionally, did philosophers and do philosophers have trouble understanding how Judaism relates to current times? And again, current times could be, you know, 1,000 years ago, depending on the era in which they live. But is that one of the basic problems that some of the great thinkers have, is how this antiquated belief system or religion, depending on how you want to refer to it, could apply to what's happening today?
I don't think it's antiquated. It's ancient. There's a difference between ancient and antiquated. Yes, people certainly have difficulty understanding how it relates to things that are happening in the world in which we live. Their difficulties were different in different ages. In the Rambam's age, or at least for the audience that he was addressing, it was a philosophical difficulty. At that time, if you read Rambam and really believe it's reflective of what was going on in the intellectual world of the day, Greek philosophy was rampant and it presented a major challenge. And people wanted to know how much of it is compatible with Jewish teaching and how much of it is incompatible with Jewish teaching, and therefore the Rambam wrote the entire Mor Nevuchim. In the contemporary age, I don't really think that the man in the street is troubled by philosophical problems. The problems in our age tend to be more sociological and matters of attitude towards social mores, where Judaism parts company with a great deal of the intellectual commitments of contemporary society. And, of course, it's necessary to know both where Judaism parts company and why it parts company. For example, if you talk about the immunity of Maamad Har Sinai, the immunity of Halacha, then you realize why certain things cannot change simply because the vogue has changed over a period of time. It's important for everyone to realize why it is that one simply can't wave a rabbinical wand and change practices of Judaism. The reason you can't do that is rooted in matters of philosophy and matters in faith, and some of those issues are discussed in the book.
Right. Rabbi J. David Bleich, Rabbi Daniel Feldman with us via telephone. We're talking about the brand new book, The Philosophical Quest, The Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. Where would we be in this whole area without the Rambam? Is it the fact that he took, is one of the benefits to exploring this area is that he took on these issues at a very sensitive time and in a head-on fashion, as you mentioned with Mora Nevuchim and so many others works of his, and therefore he laid a foundation for this whole topic?
The Rambam's importance should never be minimized. But the Rambam was not the only person by any means who grappled with these problems. In terms of what was going on in the intellectual world of the day, there were others who took issue with the Rambam, to be sure.
Right.
But those were over relatively minor points. Rambam and Hashgach is certainly at work here. Divine Providence plays a role in everything, including intellectual development. The Rambam certainly became the best known of the Jewish philosophers, and as I have argued in the book, insofar as Hilchos Deos are concerned, laws governing belief and faith, the Rambam has become the normative source. How that happened over a period of a few centuries, not a terribly long period of time, is a separate issue entirely. But halacha, in terms of its codification, it becomes accepted by Klal Yisrael, Jewish people in general, sometimes with exception, sometimes without exception. In the case of the Rambam's 13 principles, for example, it did become normative and hence binding. And that means that the principles, the basic principles enunciated by the Rambam, became sanctified and, in effect, cast in concrete. Now, that is why the Rambam is probably the best known of the Jewish philosophers,
right,
the best known of the people who wrote in this area. But he certainly wasn't the only one, and for the student and the scholar, it's important to recognize him in context together with his predecessors and those who followed in the Maimonidean tradition.
Rabbi Feldman, is it possible to have a Ritz Hashkafa series without Maimonides?
Probably not.
I would guess it's a very important foundation for all the works that are included in the series, right?
Right. This is the first one, so we have yet to see which ones are going to be laid in front of us.
Yeah, but usually when someone says it's the first one, the people involved in the project, even when they're speaking about something that was just released, already know what the next one will be. Am I right?
Yes, we have a few in the pipeline.
That's what I figured, that there's already a good indication of what's going to be happening. Rabbi Bleich, you mentioned other Jewish philosophers and people who would be included in the list with the Rambam. What about non-Jewish historic philosophers? Are there any who understood where Judaism was coming from in this area?
Certainly there are ones who understood where Judaism was coming from. They were, to a significant extent, taking exception to both Judaism and where Judaism was coming from. The medieval Christian philosophers were certainly well-informed with regard to Jewish teaching in these areas, and they were certainly conversant with Rambam's writings.
So when you entitle a chapter, "Was Spinoza a Jewish Philosopher?" what's behind that?
Spinoza is a little bit different. I would not include Spinoza in the mainstream of development of Western philosophy, at least not in terms of religious philosophy. Spinoza was, in a very real sense, attacking the system, not only the Jewish system, but the system that was accepted in the intellectual world of his day. Spinoza was rejecting the theistic tradition, in my opinion, defining it out of existence. So you can redefine terms so they no longer mean what a earlier reader would have thought they meant. My title was designed to provoke. Spinoza was certainly Jewish, and Spinoza was acclaimed in some sectors of the Jewish community. And Spinoza was certainly a philosopher. But simply because one is Jewish and a philosopher does not mean that he is a Jewish philosopher, with the term Jewish serving as an adjective modifying the term philosopher.
Because at the minimum, a Jewish philosopher should have what, or bring what to the table philosophically?
A Jewish philosopher should be bringing to the table a commitment to Jewish philosophy, as understood by Jewish tradition. Jewish philosophy is the philosophy that was accepted by Jews throughout the ages. Spinoza does not accept that philosophy. There have been valiant attempts by many to point to X, Y, or Z as a kind of precursor for Spinoza, and to argue that his ideas, if they are heretical, weren't novel, and that there were earlier people who espoused the same ideas. Now, they can respond to that in one of two ways. The simple way to respond to that is by saying that if there were such people, then they too were heretics. The other way to respond is that if you think that Spinoza is to be identified with others in, for example, the Kabbalistic tradition, then you must be misunderstanding that tradition, and that tradition requires more careful explication. To talk about Spinoza and to talk about pantheism as being Jewish is almost an oxymoron. In fact, I think it is an oxymoron. One of the things that I tried to explain is, and I'm not going to try to do it on the radio,
right,
was to explain the difference between pantheism and panentheism, and how if one doesn't understand panentheism properly, one can easily fall into the trap of pantheism. So if you look at the title, was Spinoza a Jewish philosopher? The point of that chapter is to show that the philosophy of Spinoza is external and extraneous to Jewish tradition, and that one should certainly not include Spinoza in the pantheon of Jewish philosophers.
Wow, amazing. All right, J. David Blech with us live via telephone. All right, Daniel Feldman is with us. He is the series editor of the Reitz Hashkafa series. All right, Feldman, I'm always curious, and not that you have to reveal any of these secrets, but when a publisher goes ahead and wants to tackle a topic like this and release a book like this to the public, are you asked to have a little rachmanis, to have a little sympathy on the average reader out there, to try to make this work a little bit more pedestrian than it might be? You just heard Rabbi Bleich and his scholarly analysis of a very sensitive philosophical topic. Is there a way to make those topics a little bit more for the Hamon Am?
Well, as you mentioned in your introduction of Rabbi Bleich has a wonderful ability to be profoundly clear at the same time while being incredibly sophisticated. And I think that's a hallmark of all the books in our series, and our Halacha series already has a second volume coming out in the next few weeks. So in terms of our series overall, we have a few volumes out there. And that's the general motif that we're going for, that we think that the content is very sophisticated and representative of the output of their authors, but at the same time, hopefully is written in such a way and presented in such a way that at least sophisticated lay leadership will appreciate it and will be able to grow from it.
And were you asked to give that area special attention?
That type of writing?
Yes.
That is our goal in general with these English volume works and with these series, with the Halacha series and the Hashkafa series.
So it's no secret. We're trying to make sure that as many people as possible can appreciate it.
Right.
What's been included in the Halacha series, by the way?
Well, the Halacha series, we have one volume that's already been out for a little while. It's Rabbi Tzvi Sobolovsky on the Laws of Nida. And right now in press, and hopefully will be ready in a few weeks, will be available in a few weeks, is Rabbi Mordechai Willig on Bishul B'Shabbos.
Wow, amazing. We're talking about the brand new book, The Philosophical Quest of Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. Rabbi J. David Bleich, Rabbi Daniel Feldman are with us. All Cohen and Magid books are available, Jewish bookstores everywhere, including J. Levine on West 30th Street between Broadway and Fifth Avenues in Manhattan. The commuter special is well known. You bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color. Order a subscription to the print edition of the current Talmud Bavli. You get your free digital edition. It's compatible on all mobile devices, including iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. Package has a $60 value for each volume. It's perfect for your commute to work. Go to korenpub.com. korenpub.com. When you use the promo code JM in the AM at checkout, you save, save, save. Again, that's KorenPub.com. Yeshiva University and Magid Books is in partnership on the Ritz Hashkafa series. The Philosophical Quest is the brand new book, and of course, Magid Books, an imprint of Koren Publishers. Rabbi Bleich, there's always an interesting combination of ethics and Jewish law. A lot of Jewish law, one would say, exists because of its ethical value. Some ethical traditions in our tradition, are attributable to the way we deal with halacha. I don't know if we could put a number to this or a percentage, but how would you evaluate the bridge, the togetherness, the cohesiveness of both ethics and halacha together?
I think the short answer is that in Judaism there is no sharp demarcation between ethics and halacha. There's the famous statement of the Chazon Ish that ethics and halacha are really the same, two sides of the same coin. But one of the chapters in the book, it deals with the issue of whether there is an ethic beyond halacha. Now, essentially, what I try to say in that chapter is that you have to define the term ethics properly and then decide whether you call that halacha, whether you call it something else. It's clear, and beginning with the statement of the Bar Tanur in his introduction to Pirkei Avos, that ethical values in Judaism are not developed internally. By that I mean they are not the product of the human intellect, that those values were received at Har Sinai together with everything else. Basically, it seems to me that if you're going to talk about a dichotomy between ethics and halacha, you're talking about things that are normatively mandated, things that are absolute, and other things that involve a morality of aspiration. Values that are concretized in human conduct, human action, but are not necessarily demanded of everyone, with the caveat that some people are held to higher standards, but it doesn't become a matter of normative halacha, which is binding on everyone. The bottom line is that ethics is a branch of halacha, and that you have to look at halacha to define the values that are expressed in any ethical system, and that it's not something that can be derived from society. It's not relative, and it's certainly not subjective.
Is there a good example of that outside of Noahide laws? I assume that that's one of the things you meant in terms of the, it's different for B'nai Noah, who as well have an obligation not to kill, for instance, not to murder people, while some of the laws that we are given halachically might not seem, I don't know, as severe or as important. It may be different. We may be held to a higher standard, as you said. But are there other examples aside from those two aspects that you could give in terms of who might be required to act more ethically than others?
The example of the Noach, I don't think, is quite the accurate example of a distinction between halacha and ethics, because the seven mitzvahs of the Noach are normative and mandatory. The definition and the content of those mitzvahs may be somewhat different. The concept in halacha is basically the difference between din and lifnim mishuras hadin. And to take a simple example, some cases lost property that has been abandoned by the owner does not have to be returned, even though the rightful owner can be identified. That's as a matter of din, a strict normative law. Lifnim mishuras hadin, which I regard as an ethical dimension, requires its return. Now, is this lifnim mishuras hadin, this ethical moment, is it binding upon everyone? Is it not binding upon everyone under all circumstances? That is itself a halachic matter. There are circumstances in which you can even compel comportment which goes beyond the letter of the law. so that, you know, restoration of lost property that the owner has long since given up hope for retrieving is probably just the tip of the iceberg, but it's a fairly common example in halachic writing where there's a distinction between halacha and, or din better, and lifnei mishuras hadin.
So just to reiterate my mistake, then one cannot say that because of our obligation of kibud av va'em, for instance, we have a higher ethical standard than other societies, because that would strictly be for us in the area of halacha.
To talk about gradations of ethical standards is to measure it against I don't know what.
Right.
I hesitate to use words such as we have a higher standard than others. That's a judgment, and I understand the chauvinism that prompts that judgment. Indeed, it may be true.
Right.
But it's not the way that Jewish tradition looks at these things. Jewish tradition recognizes that there are different obligations for Jews, different obligations for non-Jews, and even within Judaism, a Talmid Chacham is held to a higher standard. And that's even a normative rule in very significant ways. Yes, you can say that the Talmud Chacham is held to a higher standard, if by higher you mean more stringent. It usually turns out that this higher standard, in quotation marks, turns out to be much more demanding. But that isn't what I would call higher or lower. There are different standards for different people or different peoples, and different standards for different circumstances. Some are appropriate to one group, others are appropriate to another group. Some are appropriate in some circumstances, and some are appropriate in other circumstances. Should one aspire to what we commonly call higher standards? Probably yes. But for that, you've got to study Jewish ethics in order to understand the framework in which all of this has to be defined.
So then, and let me ask this to both of you then. So then, Rabbi Bleich, when you hear of a member of our community who's being lauded internationally for returning money that he found by accident on a piece of furniture that he purchased, and I would guess halachically, or maybe according to strict halacha, I'm not a rabbi, but I would guess halachically one can make a case that it did not have to be returned. When you hear that it was returned, you say?
Bravo. I gather that we're dealing with this. Again, I don't know the facts of the circumstance.
Understood.
There are conceivably certain fact patterns in which it would be foolish to return, and I'm not going to spell those out.
Right.
It wouldn't be adhering to a higher system of ethics or a form of lifnei mishuras hadin, or even a kind of kiddush Hashem.
Right.
If we're dealing with a circumstance in which the seller never had title to what it was that he was selling, namely the cash that was contained in the drawer, then the return wouldn't have been very significant as far as I'm concerned. I might be lauded for it, but in order to laud him for returning it, it would have to be established that he returned it to the rightful owner. Returning lost property to anyone other than the rightful owner isn't a halachic value or even an ethical value. And of course, if you want to put a fine patina on it, you can make it look very, very good. Now, in this case, I suspect that it did belong to the person who returned it. I suspect that the person did have prior title as a matter of halacha, in which case you're dealing with matters that may even be, strictly speaking, din, not even lifnei mishuras hadin. The person may have been doing what is required of every individual, and that depends upon the particular facts of the case, and I certainly don't know any more than I read in the newspapers.
Understood. Rabbi Feldman, aside from what Rabbi Bleich said, any reaction in the context of ethics and halacha to that type of situation?
Yeah, I would be inclined, for what it's worth, to agree that it's not clear that this is a situation in which he wasn't obligated, strictly speaking, from the law. It could be that the law did obligate him, strictly speaking, to return the property, but it certainly is a fulfillment of what I think Rabbi Bleich was talking about earlier in terms of the values that the halacha is advocating for those who are striving to fulfill every aspect of the law. and for somebody who is on a higher personal level, and is definitely to be applauded.
I think the real reason why he's applauded to the degree that he is because nobody else would do it, or at least that's the way people view it. I remember once saying to somebody, it's amazing, of all the people that so many of us have dealt with, you're the only one who, pays on time, who makes sure to, to call and take care of things the way they should be taken care of. And they said, I don't know what the big deal is. Maybe you're comparing us to everybody else, and therefore we look good, but this is the way we're supposed to do it. And I would assume that's the point that both of you are making in this regard.
I hope it's not true that nobody else would do it then.
Right. Well, yeah, I know, but it seems that the way that our media, our worldwide media views things like this, they would assume that nobody else would do it. Maybe they themselves would not. One of the topics that are covered in the philosophical quest, and I want to get to it here, is the issue of tikkun olam, Jewish obligations in a non-Jewish society. I know that there is an obligation to be a standard bearer, to lead the way, so to speak, on ethical matters, to be a good example. And I think in this conversation we've already touched on some of the things that one could consider an obligation of our contribution to non-Jewish society. But Rabbi Bleich, beyond that, how would one take this overused term of tikkun olam? Not in your case, I'm saying overused because I think in general people like to cite it, and sometimes in an incorrect manner. How do we use this title of Tikkun Olam and talk about Jewish obligations in a non-Jewish society? What is that obligation?
I tried to make the point in the article that the obligation exists on two levels. We do not have an obligation to missionize in terms of human behavior, at least not in the contemporary world. Things were different in the Jewish Commonwealth when you had resident aliens. The obligations with regard to techocha, admonition, et cetera, are internal to members of the Jewish community. However, and I tried to marshal a whole array of sources indicating that our influence upon non-Jewish society is designed to be primarily by example. We are supposed to be living examples of the way people should live, society should comport itself, et cetera, et cetera. That's point number one. The second point is that I think there's an obligation that goes beyond that. The obligation going beyond that is to respond to particular queries. When our advice is sought with regard to social, ethical, moral issues, I think we have an absolute obligation to respond, and to respond accurately, not responding by telling people what they want to hear, not to responding in terms of that which is politically correct at a particular time, or to put it very bluntly, without sugarcoating. So that Jews certainly have an obligation. The question is, and how are they supposed to go out to discharge that obligation? That's not easy. That itself is an exercise in Talmud Torah.
I think that we could come up with many, many examples, but the person or the type of person we might feel the worst for is somebody in the world of government, very high profile, who's called upon to make judgments on social issues. I mean, based on what you just said, I don't know how somebody who represents our tradition would be able to go and be pro-choice, for instance. They'd probably have an obligation to espouse the point of view of the halachists in our history and how they would view a topic like abortion. Am I right?
They certainly do, and I have no hesitation in saying so. Again, I certainly don't look for guidance in those quarters, but prominent spokesmen of the Catholic Church have made exactly the same statement, that a person cannot become a political schizophrenic and claim he has a private personam as different from a public personam. In his public actions, he is supposed to be acting in conformity with a certain ethical and moral code. For Jews, it's in conformity with a halakhic code. At the very minimum, the halakhic code that governs B'nai Noach. And that's an absolute obligation. The person has no right to deviate from that simply because that's the way to stay in office.
So even in my example, or even somebody who wanted to be strict about Noahide law in that type of example, they would not be able to rely on, well, I would never endorse it in any way, shape, or form, but I also don't want government to, quote-unquote, interfere in people's lives. That would be an unacceptable approach.
Totally unacceptable. One of the seven commandments of Noach is the mitzvah of dinim. The mitzvah of dinim is to enforce the first six, according to Rambam. And he also adds that a part of the mitzvah of dinim is lahazir es ha'om, to admonish people with regard to their responsibilities. Government is supposed to interfere in those areas. Government probably should not be interfering in areas that are not within the boundaries of Sheva Mitzvot Noach. But to the extent that there are social matters that fall within those categories, the government, ideally speaking, should be there to promote the seven Noachite commandments and to assure that people adhere to them.
So this issue recently with the type of marriages that are now allowed in the United States, for instance, in many states of the United States, for instance, that may be a little bit more of a grayer area because we don't know if that would fall under Noahide laws or not, or am I wrong?
Oh, it certainly does fall under Noahide laws.
No question about it.
And we have the Talmudic statement to the effect that even the immoral people of antiquity did not write marriage contracts for homosexual unions. In effect, what they're saying is they recognized it was wrong. They may have acted in the way that they acted, but they didn't try to give it a social imprimatur. The marriage ceremony certainly doesn't contribute anything to the relationship per se. Either the act is permissible or the act is not permissible. Either it's a transgression or it's not a transgression. What the marriage ceremony does is to give social sanction. It says that we are acceptive of all of this and that we regard it as an alternative lifestyle and something which is within the realm of both the norm and the acceptable. That's totally contrary to Jewish teaching.
So not that this is our topic of today, but we're in a lot of trouble in this country. We have a lot of serious issues that we have to take up.
Well, we are in exile. There's no question that we are living in a non-Jewish society and that the values of this society are not the same as the values of Judaism. We can't even talk about a Judeo-Christian tradition as generations past were able to speak. We're living in a post-Christian era.
We're way beyond it at this point. Rabbi Feldman, is there any effort to take the philosophical quest and send it to every member of Congress? Has this been discussed?
That's a great marketing idea.
Maybe we can make a difference in Washington. You know, that's where it all starts in this country.
If Corin wants to do that, we're definitely behind it.
I could just see Yeshiva University and Magid Books and Corin being cited for influencing what's going on in the nation's capital. And by the way, I would guess, Rabbi Bleich, that this whole issue of physician-assisted suicide falls under the category that we were just speaking of, correct?
Absolutely.
Same type of a dialogue in regard to where this falls and what the obligation of a physician is to his patient and, even more importantly, to his heritage and faith.
It goes to the issue of euthanasia, put aside physician-assisted suicide. That's a step further, but the entire matter of euthanasia and what's happening in terms of our social mores is a very serious issue, and it has a direct impact upon Jews. Number one, because Jews tend to be influenced more by what they read on the op-ed page of the newspaper than by the Shulchan Aruch, and B, because, as the Yiddish expression goes, Shvetz Zayin Ayid, it's difficult to exist in a society that does not accept your principles and your your ethical commitment in areas that go to matters of literally life and death.
You've written on so many topics. We mentioned in the introduction Perfect Faith, Jewish Bioethics. You're a professor of law and ethics at Yeshiva University. How did you first get into this area? What was the first ethical challenge that you took up to analyze and expose to the public?
It's hard to say. I was teaching as long as I can remember, and I was teaching these courses. I remember probably the first significant article that I wrote was on abortion. And it came, it was the beginning of interest and writing in the area of bioethics. And that came because I live in an area in which there were many interns and residents in the local hospitals. I live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And there are at least half a dozen hospitals within easy walking distance. And the interns and the residents were in the pews of my shul and coming with their questions, their problems, and they required answers that weren't exactly glib. And that sparked the original interest, and things just took off from there.
Evolved from there. And that was before Roe v. Wade or after?
It was before Roe versus Wade.
And so you've seen a progression in terms of attitude in this country that's exactly the opposite, I would guess, of what you would hope for in terms
absolutely.
In terms of that area.
Right. In the last 4 or 5 decades, we have seen an erosion of what I would label Jewish values in bioethics.
How about the, how do I put this? And I don't think you address this in the book, but I'm so curious from your perspective. There's more luxury, more wealth, more disposable income in the Jewish community than there's probably ever been. Some might argue that I'm not being 100% accurate on that, but I think you know what I mean. Is there, in your mind, a correlation between ethical behavior and the, or lack of ethical behavior, and when, in fact, bank accounts are swelled and there's more disposable income available?
You and I didn't discover the correlation. It's the Pasuk in Chumash, Vayishman Yeshua and Vayivot. As Jethro waxes fat, he becomes rebellious. When people have more disposable income, they have more to dispose it in terms of acquiring things with their largesse. And that creates greater temptation. A person who has a subsistence income doesn't question whether gambling is permissible or not permissible. He doesn't have the funds that he could invest in a gaming table. That's true in general. It's on a very crude and basic level, it even goes to whether you can afford medical procedures that aren't entirely legitimate. If you don't have the money, you can't afford it, so it doesn't become a problem in the first place. The Jewish community is affluent, relatively speaking, certainly more affluent than it was in ages past. That's not necessarily bad. By any means, I'm not speaking from the material vantage point, even in terms of the spiritual vantage point. You have thousands and thousands of young men who are spending huge chunks of their life doing nothing but studying Torah. I think that we have more people studying in various yeshivas and kollelim today than at any point in Jewish history. And that's possible to a large extent because we're affluent enough to be able to afford it. These people are being supported, in quotation marks, in one way or another. And it's because we're able to do this. And that's wonderful. I'm sure that's part of divine hashkocha. But together with it, it means that there are people who can do all sorts of things that they shouldn't be doing. They are earning money not simply as workers and artisans, but in the world of finance, in the upper echelons of the business world. And that presents all sorts of temptations, and some people succumb. And that is not something that we should be happy about.
No question about that. Rabbi Feldman, I hope you're not upset that I've drifted into a Musser schmooze here while discussing philosophy.
No, not at all. It all goes together.
I guess it does. Doesn't it all go together? Rabbi Feldman, I noticed that the last chapter of the book discusses should religion inform public debate. And I think through some of what I brought up, you could pick up that I'm slightly hesitant about avoiding a completely social libertarian agenda, one that probably does not fit completely within our tradition. So what is your reaction to that, Rabbi Feldman, about the bridge of religion actually having a major effect on the public debate?
I sympathize very much with what Rabbi Bleich is saying, and I think especially in terms of some of the specific issues that you raised, even if one wants to take a little bit more of a detached perspective, But the opposite attitude, the attitude that one's religious tradition should have no bearing on their political roles and their political positions, is one that certainly seems to be an anathema. The idea that, for example, a question like abortion, which from any perspective is clearly going to pose certain clear moral issues, and to say that the source of one's entire religious upbringing and personal wisdom has to be completely disconnected from that, that would seem to make no sense, and would seem to be a very strong version of freedom from religion, so to speak, of saying that the most basic wisdom coming from the religion has no place in the public sphere. I think that's an especially egregious attitude.
No, I know you're right. You're right, Black. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Jews are a very religious people. It's deeply ingrained in their psyche. So even when they become secular, they're also religious. They have a secular religion. In this country, the major principle of secular Judaism is the separation of church and state.
Right.
And I understand historically why Jews welcomed the separation of church and state. We, however, have gone a little bit overboard. And that's in part because of the development of constitutional jurisprudence over something like 200 years. The founding fathers certainly didn't envision the kind of separation which has been endorsed by recent Supreme Courts. The net result is that we are almost embarrassed to mention any religious source or tradition with regard to social policy, and pretend that our social policies are entirely religion-free. That's not terribly healthy. I think that we would be a lot healthier as a society if we recognize that there are values that are rooted in religious traditions, and I use the plural advisedly, and that there need not be an absolute separation of religious values and the secular state. Now, there's a very thin line, and one has to be careful not to cross the line.
Right.
And part of the political problem is, and how can you trust politicians not to cross the line? I don't pretend to have the answers to all the questions, but it would be nice if we recognize what our value system is, and even nicer if we were consulted once in a while with regard to how these traditions ought to inform public policy.
Rabbi Bleich, let me save at least part of my, or at least a little sliver of my social libertarian agenda. You agree with me, of course, that government should not be enforcing us to wear seatbelts while driving, correct?
No.
You do agree with me or disagree?
I agree. I agree that government should be forcing us to wear seatbelts while driving.
I have no hope.
because in terms of, quote, the spirit, close quote, of Jewish tradition and Jewish law, had we been living in the days of Chazal, I am sure there would have been a formal edict to that effect, because they enacted all kinds of legislation to preserve public health and safety. If they prohibited drinking exposed liquids because a snake might deposit some venom, which was rare even in those days, they would have been concerned about other activities that compromise health and life. That doesn't mean that it's a violation of Jewish law if you don't put on your seatbelt. That's a technicality. Nobody has enacted such an edict, therefore it's not binding across the board. But it's clear that society has the right to enact those types of legislation.
Right.
And if government is acting as the legislative arm of society in doing things of that nature, I think it's well within the ambit of governmental authority as recognized by Judaism. It's a kind of takonas hatzibur. It's for the welfare of society, and society has the right to protect itself and individual members, even the ones who don't want to be protected. Again, that goes to the issue of autonomy. Jewish teaching with regard to personal autonomy is quite different from what is accepted in the world out there. In terms of the world out there, you've got to justify any restriction upon individual liberty. And basically, people shouldn't be telling me what to do, and certainly government ought not to be telling me what to do. In terms of Judaism, I don't have that kind of autonomy. My autonomy is severely circumscribed by the mitzvahs of the Torah. The Rabbanu Shlomo has told me what I have to do, and not only in the areas of ritual observance, but in areas that affect nobody but myself, matters pertaining to individual health and safety. And society is charged with enforcing those norms. So I'm not shocked by rules regarding seatbelts, etc.
Well, at least you've given me some ammunition the next time one of my kids wants to go bungee jumping. Now I have now I have some philosophy and Jewish tradition to fall back on and give them mussar about. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't be putting themselves in that type of situation. I take this opportunity to wish both of you a mazel tov on this brand new book. It's called The Philosophical Quest, The Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha. Rabbi Bleich, an absolute honor to have you on and to speak with you today about this. Continued success, and thank you so much for enlightening us here today with all this material.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure.
Rabbi Feldman, I take this opportunity to wish you a mazel tov as well. You are the series editor for the Reitz Hashkafa series. The Philosophical Quest is available as a YU Magid Books imprint and, of course, available at korenpub.com, courtesy of Koren Publications. Continued success as you continue to add more to this and other series.
Thank you so much, Nachum.
Thank you.
A pleasure to speak with both of you. There it is. The Philosophical Quest is brand new. Even a layman like myself can conduct somewhat of a potent conversation on this topic, and I'm so glad I was able to, and I want to thank both Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Feldman for being with us today here on By the Book. Our friends at Koren Publications remind you that all Koren and Magid books are available now at Jewish bookstores everywhere, including J. Levine on West 30th Street between Broadway and Fifth Avenues in New York City. There is a commuter's special that we bring to your attention. You could bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma in color. Order a subscription to the print edition of the Koren Talmud Bavli and get a free digital edition. The digital edition is compatible on all mobile devices, including iPod, tablet, iPad, and more. The package is a $60 value for each volume. It's perfect for your commute to work. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com, and use the promo code JM in the AM at checkout, and you can save and enjoy. Remember that By the Book airs in its original form every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the stream at jmnam.org, what we lovingly refer to as the Nachum Segal Network. And we have more interesting guests coming up courtesy of Koren Publications every single week. If you're not listening during the 10 o'clock hour Eastern Time on a Tuesday, you're listening to an encore presentation of By the Book. And again, we encourage you to go to the website to check out what Koren Publications has to offer and enjoy their incredible array of so many different types of books. We've been able to explore some amazing scholarly works over the last few weeks, and this one, Rabbi J. David Bleich from the Reitz Hashkafa series on The Philosophical Quest, is one of them. The Philosophical Quest, The Philosophy, Ethics, Law, and Halacha, Yeshiva University, Magid Books. Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman is the series editor, and we continue to recommend Koren Publications. Go to their website, korenpub.com. That's korenpub.com. And a reminder that all Koren and Magid books are available at Jewish bookstores everywhere, including J. Levine on West 30th Street in Manhattan. And don't forget to bring the Beit HaMikdash to life by studying Maseches Yoma and getting your free digital edition. All the information is on the website at korenpub.com. In order to take advantage of the Talmud special, make sure you use the code JM in the AM at checkout. You have been listening to this edition of By the Book at the Nachum Segal Network. Make sure to join us at 10 a.m. Eastern Time every Tuesday on the Nachum Segal Network and jmandtheam.org for more exploration into the world of publications with our friends at Koren Publications, korenpub.com, right here at the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.
Thank you.